This is Talking Dementia with Remo Health. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Silverman. Join us as we explore the latest advancements, insights, and strategies that help empower those living with dementia and the families that support them. Each episode, we speak with leading experts, from physicians and researchers to policymakers and clinicians, to provide you with the resources needed to navigate this complex disease. Today, we're speaking with Matt Lecrae, Remo co-founder and chief product officer. Matt's father is living with a type of dementia called semantic variant primary progressive aphasia. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Matt, tell us about yourself. Where are you located and what's your life like these days?
Life these days is very Remo-centric. So I live with my wife in Jackson, Wyoming, and do my best to try to be a good leader for the team and try to also live up to what my dad taught me to be as a husband and a son. So that's pretty much a full plate these days.
Tell us about growing up with your dad. What was he like and what was his personality and what was your relationship like?
Growing up, it was great in retrospect, and now even being in a position in my own life to think about potentially being a father or being a husband. I think there's just a new way in which you re-meet a parent as an adult. It prompts a lot of reflection. So he was a wonderful man. I mean, he was an incredibly loving, kind, funny guy. He's an absolute rascal. So we use that word a lot in the house. I think he was always very adamant about being there for his family. And he was very adamant about learning and trying to better yourself and trying to live a life for people about more than just yourself. And for him, that was very much his family. And that's something that he taught me that I've really internalized and I think about every day. I think I knew him very well until I was probably in high school. And then I think high school probably started, we'll call it chapter two or phase two of our relationship, where we kind of didn't really know each other very well at all. And I think for a variety of reasons, our relationship got more complicated. And I think we placed a lot of bets on what our adult relationship would be. And that now brings us to the phase that we're in currently, which is, why does Remo exist? Well, Remo exists because that relationship that we were hoping to have, or certain ails in our relationships, are now sort of buried in a tomb of dementia. And we're never going to be able to work through or revisit some of those areas that I think we were both hoping, even if it was never explicitly stated, we're both hoping to revisit and make peace with as two adult men coming back to meet each other, father and son, or husband and husband, or parent and parent. And I think that's been one of the most challenging parts, but also one of the most motivating parts on a daily basis for me. So it's been a long road, three phases.
In the second phase, you said that the two of you placed a lot of bets on the future. What do you mean by that?
We're both very work focused and both very achievement oriented. I learned that from him, and it was something deeply encouraged. And the drawback of that is there's more to life than your job or being a student or how much money that you make. And that work ethic that Remo, my mom's dad, his father instilled in him and my parents, and then we took away from our upbringing. The downside of that is that every time you say yes to something, you say no to something else. And my father and I said yes to trying to achieve things with our lives that meant we were going to say no to a lot of other things. And for us, that was our relationship outside of our work and our achievements. And so it's a very performance-oriented life. But I think as a consequence, it's only now after my dad's diagnosis that I realized there are certain parts of ourselves that we never got to know at all. And now we'll never know.
Yeah, I remember when my mom developed dementia, it happened a lot faster than any of us expected. And as she was approaching the end of her life, I remember saying to myself, like, if there's anything you want to ask her, or any conversation you want to have with her, you better have it now because she's not going to be around for a long time. But even toward the end, it wasn't fully possible to ask those questions and have those conversations just because of her state of mind. And so I think I see what you mean. And I want to get to that more. But before we go down that road, because that's a very heavy one, maybe we can walk back and talk about you and him and your family and the journey to a diagnosis. Because my understanding is that in some ways the diagnosis came quickly and was straightforward, but in some ways it really did not come quickly and was not straightforward. There's like a little bit of a paradox buried in there. So I was wondering if you can talk about that journey and that experience of finally understanding this new chapter.
The diseases under the umbrella of dementia, we do our best to find a word to anchor some commonalities between what you experience, but what you experience as a family member in the earliest stages, it's obvious in retrospect, right? So now looking back 7 years, but one of the tricky pieces in the journey to diagnosis is coping with and or trying to figure out how much of this and what I'm seeing can I explain away by parts of our relationship that are broken or need work or are just part of our natural journey growing as people and as father and son in the case with my dad, and how much is actual pathology. It's really hard to tell sometimes, but it is now obvious and there are certain key things that we did start to notice, but I think we're really good, whether it's anthropologically or otherwise, at knowing when something's up. I think every caregiver, every family member is able to somehow really know that something is awry well before you ever find yourself at an academic medical research center going through watching your family member struggle to draw a clock, or somebody who has been historically throughout their life so smart and sort of your hero in so many ways, then fumble being able to recognize a basic animal or recall a word. And well before that, there are things that rear their ugly head or hint at you that something is awry. And it's a completely individual process with everybody's ability to start to be honest with themselves about, wait, something is in the bucket of, okay, this is a struggle we have as father and son or as a partner, or wait, no, this is odd that we keep returning to these same behaviors or words. We now need to get the help of the healthcare system involved. And there are answers that I cannot find because I can't understand what I'm experiencing with this person. What this person is presenting is so far beyond what is air quotes normal for them or for us as a family.
I'm remembering a play I saw that was called Unraveled, and it was about this painter. Her name was Anne, and she didn't start off a painter. She started actually as a biologist and was a very talented biologist and spent all her time in the lab looking at things under the microscope and very science-oriented. And then slowly over time developed this aptitude for the arts, and then one day made this decision to quit her science job and just paint all the time. She started off painting strawberries, strawberry after strawberry after strawberry. And her husband in the play is trying to understand, is this just the new Anne? Is this a personality change?
Does this have to do with our relationship? Is she having an affair? Is she having a midlife crisis? Mm-hmm. Or is something changing in her brain? And it's interesting to watch them as a couple negotiate her behavior changes and realize ultimately that it's a symptom of a disease. And so I'm wondering if you could give us an example or two of a behavior. You know, in her case, it was creativity, which is interesting because it's actually neutral to positive, you could say. Although she did quit her job, so there's probably negative aspects
right.
as well. Right. But what were some of the behaviors that you noticed, if you're comfortable sharing, that had you wondering, like, is this just a relationship thing or a personality thing, or is this part of a disease?
This is one of those things that now seems obvious in retrospect, that the best way I've been able to articulate it to anybody that ever asks is, no matter what conversation we were having, and this is back in 2015 or 2016, almost 8 years ago, depends on where you want to start the clock, but it was like my dad had a playlist with only three songs. And every time a conversation would begin, it would press play, but it would ultimately end up only playing one of those three songs. And it didn't matter what the conversation was. And this is where, when I was saying earlier, it's hard to determine, hey, what is just the nature of our relationship and the work we have or haven't done to put sunlight and water on our relationship as father and son, but everything only returning back to one of three stories about his dad or two work stories. It just was really strange. Hey, here's this great, incredible woman I met named Chantal. And then we start talking about work. And at the time, I just remember being so frustrated by that, being like, ah, you know, you're not listening, or you feel ignored, or you feel misunderstood, or you say to yourself, man, this is so frustrating. Every single time I'm trying to open up a new part of my life to you, you just keep going back to the same thing about you. And at first, you know, I was a young man and trying to build a life of my own, and I'm sure frustrating and a annoying young son who's trying to grow from teenager to man and in his own way. And so you have friction, but that is the best way I can describe it, is it didn't matter what conversation we were having. It was like any vector of life would ultimately return back to those same three tracks. And that went on for probably 2 years. And there were parts of that 2 year stretch where now I think my brother, my sister, me, it's hard not to feel guilty or look at what was happening with the knowledge we have now and not backcast and say, oh, we should have done X, or we should have gone earlier, or if I had only known that was happening, then maybe we could have had that conversation about what happened when I was little earlier. But you can't go backwards. That's been very inspiring in many ways for how I live my life now and how we try to live our lives as a family, and even parts of how I try to lead at Remo, I think is all really inspired by that. But nevertheless, it was this 12 to 24 month journey of starting to recognize this pattern of, no matter where we are or what we're talking about, leading back to one of these three things, this is odd. And there's something more here than meets the eye. And it was really divisive. It was not a smooth, harmonious, great family coming together. It was maddening and frustrating and led to a lot of turmoil and splitting between siblings. And then finally, I found myself in the position of, oh, holy smokes. Dad just went from being walkie-talkie to all of a sudden forced into retirement because all his customers for his business left mysteriously in the span of 3 to 6 months. They're just gone. And mom and dad were planning on him working for 6 more years. So what are we going to do? And then you have 2 years of air quotes, frustrating conversations built up. And as a family, you find yourself realizing, wait, we got to do something. And so who's now going to do it? And somebody's got to go solve that puzzle.
So at what point did the family decide to take him to the doctor? Was it losing his clients? Was it just end of the rope with the conversations? And tell us about the process of taking him to the doctor and getting him a diagnosis.
I have to give a lot of credit here to his endocrinologist at the time. My dad has adult onset type 1 diabetes, what we now call LADA. I would take him to his endocrinologist appointments, and she was the first person to notice what we would now call perseveration or disinhibition around sharing one of the parts of his talk tracks. One of the talk tracks in the songs that we were talking about a moment ago would always come back to a story about his diabetes and his insulin pump. And it was the way that he would tell it relative to the questions she would ask, where she noticed and finally said to me after one of his visits, "You're going to see something that may be a little weird in your dad's after visit summary," because I'm a healthcare data nerd. I would always log in, look at after visit summaries and what's the care plan and so forth. She said, "You're going to see a referral to a neurologist." And I said, "Why?" She's like, "I've had this suspicion for 6 or 8 months now. Your dad's starting to show changes in his memory and his ability to articulate himself that seems extremely unusual for a very smart and successful 57 or 58 year old man. And I don't know, I'm not a neurologist, but we have some really good neurologists here and I want to refer him just to see." I didn't know walking out the door that day that that was pretty much going to be one of the last good days I was going to have with my dad.
So then what happened?
Nothing. And then everything, if that makes any sense. It was cool, you're going to get a referral, but that takes a long time to see a neurologist. Think about the last time you went to your doctor and they said, "Hey, we're going to refer you to so-and-so." A, how many times do you actually follow through? And B, how enjoyable is it? Oh yeah, I'm super pumped to take work off and go drive 4 hours and then put everything else on hold and move my whole schedule. And then I'm going to show up and nobody's going to know what I'm talking about. I have to repeat myself 8 times. Nobody shares information with each other. Nobody knows why I'm there. They're late. I'm waiting. It just like, how many referrals do you actually end up following through? And then if you do, how long does it take to actually get there to see a specialist? And there are all kinds of things that we put in the way of doing that. And we were absolutely guilty of that. You know, we're not superhuman. We're not special in any way. We're folks that had no idea what we were dealing with. So 6 months later, I say, okay, I'll go for sure. I'll take work off, and went to bring him to the neurologist. And that was the first crossing of the Rubicon, I would say. That first neurology visit, you just knew that something was just super odd. The way that he communicated, the repeating of the talk tracks was shorter, less clear, less congruent. And I had noticed something that I felt terrible about when I was in that first neurology visit. I had noticed that when I had taken my dad to dinner, historically, my dad was super good with numbers, but I noticed that he kept using his phone to calculate tips and was really struggling, seemingly, to do the basic addition of adding a tip onto a meal. And I didn't think really too much of it until we got there, and then you start going through your MOCA or your MIMSI, and it's like, oh, okay, we have a real problem. Like, my dad can't do basic math. My dad can't remember 3 words that were just told to him. He can't remember where a dollar bill was placed in the room at the beginning of the visit, and then 10 minutes later, he doesn't know where it is.
And for the listeners, now you're no longer in the restaurant, you're in the neurology appointment, and they're doing these formal tests, like quizzes, where they'll have him do math problems or have him try to remember 3 words that were said 10 minutes ago, that kind of thing.
Yeah, there are things that are part of a standard neurological exam. They're testing for hey, are different parts of the brain working as expected, especially for a 58-year-old man? And just because of how we were living or sticking our heads in the sand or whatever you want to call it, that neurology visit, you could see literally because you're just having a conversation with a physician who knows what questions to ask and has the objectivity to not know anything about really you or him and is just objectively trying to look at motor function and executive function and behavior and so forth. And that's just when I realized, okay, this is definitely abnormal, but where do we go from here and what do? And that kicked off a saga.
Did you get a diagnosis at that appointment?
No, it was confirmed that the suspicion was justified. And that is when we got a referral to neuropsychiatric evaluation. And so for anybody who is unfamiliar, or I hope never has to go through this, it's a multi-hour battery of tests. Imagine somebody locked you in a room and made you do your SAT, ACT, every standardized test you could think of, and do that for a day. And that is sort of the best tooling that we have, combined with the professional healthcare provider who knows what to look for in the course of administering those standard batteries of tests. Those two things put together are the first of two major sets of tests that we do to figure out, is there some form of dementia present? And if so, what subtype? That original neurology exam and referral to neuropsych, it took 8 more months to get a definitive diagnosis after that. So we went from that neurology visit, neuropsych testing at one institution, then imaging, and then second opinion, and then probably denial and reorienting around what was this information as a family and what does that portend? And then a call to action, for lack of a better term, and kind of a recognition that we're going to have to figure something out.
So his diagnosis is very specific. It's semantic variant primary progressive aphasia. Mm-hmm. Where did you get that diagnosis?
We got that from the Hoover Neuroscience Center at Stanford. That came after the first round of neuropsych testing and imaging. And we had never heard that before or didn't know what that meant. And so in some sort of weird, crazy coincidence, after we had gotten that and after we had realized what that may or may not mean, three things happened in the span of a couple of days. The first was we walked out of that neuroscience center, and I'm sure everybody has a moment that they can relate to with this. And it sounds like you had a moment as well where you both know that father and son has now been redefined in a certain way. There's a one-way door that you've gone through where there's going to be a patient caregiver element. Who we were, the relationship we had up to this point has been redefined. And you hear this all the time when folks especially go through something like a cancer diagnosis. The diagnosis comes and you don't really fully understand what it means, but you know that it's not good. And you know that it's now redefining the life that you thought you were going to have into something that is completely unknown. My dad and I just kind of looked at each other, and my dad said, hey, I'm really sorry. I'm not going to be able to be there for you in the way that we thought I was going to be able to. But I want you to know that I'm proud of you. That was the moment that we both knew, and I also will never forget. It was just painted like a clear picture in my brain. We were on Stanford's campus. We were in front, for those that have been there, there's a big cathedral in the main quad of the campus, and we were standing there, and it was a blue sky day. And I remember hearing that and just giving him a big hug, and I said, Dad, I promise you, I don't know what this is even going to mean, but I promise you that we're going to do everything we possibly can to make this better for anybody who has to go through it. And that was the moment where I certainly knew I was going to be a caregiver, but I had no idea where the journey was going to lead. And I certainly had no idea how deep and broad the problem went at that time. And I had no idea in that moment just how many other families were going through the same thing and confronting the same challenges. And here we are.
One thing I've learned from my encounters with Remo is that getting to a diagnosis is very important. And so here's this moment in your story where you've arrived at a diagnosis. And in some ways, it feels like an ending, like there's an answer. We have a word, a phrase, a disease name for what's been going on. And in other ways, it feels like the beginning.
Yes.
And like you said, it's a medical diagnosis, but there's also so much narrative rupture that happens there, having to do with identity and relationships and family dynamics and uncertainty and the future. And there's also, I would guess, as somebody who isn't in the medical field, you and your dad and your family, still a confusion about, okay, we have this diagnosis. These words are really complicated. Like, is this Alzheimer's? Is this something different from Alzheimer's? One of the questions that comes up a lot in Remo is what's the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's? So just a lot being thrown at people in this moment of receiving the diagnosis. And in your case, it sounds like it was the birth of a new professional passion as well. So maybe you can take us forward into the next chapter. How did things evolve from there in terms of understanding as best you can what is to come and what to do next?
First of all, you're entirely correct. A diagnosis is this definition and clarity, but also the beginning of some sort of crazy video game that you didn't ask to play. It's like Jumanji. It like sucks you into the game. And you know, I didn't ask to be here, but now there are these crazy monkeys and animals running at me and there's monsters and there's things that I don't even know that I don't know that are here trying to screw my life up. And this happened 3 months before my wedding. My wife and I are trying to figure out a life of our own, and we are very much now, both with her parents and mine, in the sandwich generation. But you're exactly correct. You have this narrative of what you think your life's going to be, and then there's this torpedo in the water that intercepts the vessel of your life. And whether you like it or not, that presents you with a situation where you have to choose. What are you going to do? And it gives you this answer and then an entirely new universe of questions. And I have to give a lot of credit to one of my lifetime best friends. His name is Brendan McHugh. Shouts out to Brendan McHugh. His father passed away when he was a teenager from a failed fight with cancer. Why do I mention that? Because he took from that, these types of situations provide an opportunity for you to prove to yourself that you are the person you told yourself that you are, and they provide an opportunity for excellence. That was his perspective on becoming the de facto father for his five siblings at age 15. I mean, if that's not an inspiring perspective, I don't know what is. But why do I mention that at all is that getting a diagnosis thrusts that reality into your life, whether you want it to or not. For me, I thought of what Brendan had shared with me and what he went through with his dad. And I thought, well, I'm not going to let this just break. I'm not going to run for the hills. I'm not just going to abandon what I stand for, everything my dad taught me about how to be the person that I want to be. So what are we going to do? And I think the most difficult part when you start to wade into the game of dementia, let's just run with the Jumanji reference, you get sucked into the world. The first level that you think you're on is clinical. But unfortunately, the part that nobody tells you is much of the world that you're now sucked into has a non-clinical component to it, specifically legal and financial. You find yourself in the position of, wait a minute, this person that now has the diagnosis, once you start doing a little bit of Googling, you come to the conclusion really quickly that this means that they're not going to be able to think for themselves anymore. Their brain is literally not going to work. Therefore, they're not going to be able to make decisions. They're not going to be able to communicate. They're not going to be able to navigate. If it's a movement-based disorder, they're not going to be able to move around. So you start running through the checklist of daily activities and say to yourself, how is this going to work logistically? You don't even realize how many things you take for granted in a given day until something like this gets introduced into your life. And that's not even unique to dementia, but the problem is you start stepping into this world in dementia where you have to lay down an infrastructure for life to operate by proxy. And the biggest problem that that introduces is, unfortunately, most of how healthcare works as a business today is designed to address the person with the diagnosis and leaves entirely out of the equation, and I mean that literally, the person who's going to have to live with that patient. So to be really concrete, in parlance of dementia, there is infrastructure in place to treat clinically the patient. But this whole world of what you're forced into as a caregiver, you are entirely on your own. And that, in addition to the promise that I had made to my dad, that is why we are here. That is the whole saga of what has evolved since, is being on that journey and having to figure out the dynamics of family and communicating and looking at prognoses, looking at research. Are there options? Is there a cure? Okay, there isn't. So how long? Oh, everybody's different. Some people it's 13 years, some people it's 3 years. And okay, how are we going to pay for this? Oh, I don't know. Hey, mom, did you have a budget? Nope. Okay, where is your money? I don't know. And you just get thrust into these situations as a 29-year-old young man. Those are not conversations or situations that you imagine yourself having. But again, it's an opportunity to prove to myself that I was the man that I told myself I was, or had the opportunity to grow certainly into the man that I wanted to be, and to take those things that I had learned from my father and then help my family in the way that at the time they didn't know how to help themselves.
What you're saying about a tragic diagnosis opening itself up into an opportunity for excellence and an opportunity for personal growth and an opportunity for maturation into the type of person, the type of man, the type of son that you want to be really hits home for me. I've been thinking a lot lately about this concept of purpose and how these days we live in a world where we could sit on our couch all day, every day, and order things on Amazon and order things on Instacart. And, you know, in some ways, men who go to war, for example, don't take this the wrong way, but sometimes men who go to war report being the happiest in their life in some ways because they have purpose, they have a goal that they're driving toward. And so I think that's a really helpful takeaway for me, and I hope for the listeners, is maybe that's one way to look at this challenge, is suddenly everything is aligned toward a goal, a purpose, a problem, a puzzle. How are we going to work this logistically? How are we going to work this financially? And you're on an adventure. You're in your little boat in the Jumanji quagmire, and there's different predators coming at you that you're having to fight off. Where did you turn? Because you're not alone in the boat. You have your dad, your mom, your brother, your sister. You have the doctor. It sounds like their scope is limited. But where did you turn for help, for resources, for information, for support? Who was with you in the Jumanji boat, and what did that next segment look like?
I think firstly, you're spot on. I've never been to war, so I will not even venture into trying to comment on what that experience is like. But what I can absolutely say is I had always wondered what my purpose was going to be. What I definitely got from my dad, I knew my life was going to fundamentally be about others, not all about myself. And I just didn't know what that was. I was searching for a really long time. And a lot of the troubles I've had in my personal life can be rooted back to that search. And the diagnosis did introduce clarity. Certainly once I made that promise to my dad, I take promises that I make very seriously. And so it gave a sense of focus. And the unfortunate part is I was alone. No one helped at first. And my family, I love them very much, but we operated for a long time, first couple of years, under the premise of, oh, it's not Alzheimer's, so we're going to be okay. And the namesake of the company is my mom's father, Remo. And why I mention that is I had studied neuroscience and I had done research into traumatic brain injuries and neurodegenerative diseases. And so I am wired to default to action. And the first razor I try to cut any ambiguity of a situation through is, what can I control and what can't I control? I am certainly not going to be able to control what this disease does or how or where it progresses in the brain of my father, or I can't control what my mom is going to do. I can't control what my siblings are going to do. I can't control how healthcare is paid for. I can't control 15 years ago whether or not a will was set up or we have the support in place. There's so many things you can't control that the way that I'm wired is just, okay, what can I control? Well, I can start with these words, semantic variant of primary progressive aphasia, that means something. That is information. So we live in a world where fortunately access to information is no longer the problem. The hard part is sifting through and finding, well, what is relevant for the journey we're on? And what do I need to worry about now versus what can I put in the bucket of next? And what can we just worry about later? But this was the most difficult thing that in my personal life I had ever been presented with. And I was alone for a long time in trying to get a plan in place. And I think that's almost one of the first most difficult challenges, is you want to do something, but so much of what there is to do once you search and find, and the journey is a search and find. I like to say, with all due respect to the clinical folks that gave us the diagnosis, I just remember sitting there saying, okay, so what do we do? And we just got an after visit summary with a couple of links to .orgs. And I just said to myself, this is the world's most expensive good luck. This is crazy to me. How could this be this bad? How could we know so much and so little at the same time? And so what are we going to do? And there were at the time no easy answers or layups or services to hire or things to help. It was just, no, go figure this out. And I just asked myself, what can I control and what can't I control? And so what am I going to do? And it was just kind of one layer at a time, trying to work through the problem. And the craziest thing is after that, I went and tried to find as many families as I could possibly talk to. And some of those families come from backgrounds that are very resource abundant, and some are very resource scarce. And the craziest thing about dementia is it is one of the most equalizing diagnoses in existence currently, based on what all of science has to offer us, all of the infrastructure, healthcare delivery, and otherwise. It doesn't matter if you have $1 billion or $10. There are certain things that will be made easier, but at the end of the day, there is no cure and the patient can't self-manage. So what are you going to do? You are alone at first, and it does fall on you as the caregiver to confront that workload, for lack of a better term, and start doing the work inside yourself, and then doing the work to raise your hand and say, hey, I need help. If I'm interpreting this information correctly, this is a gnarly problem that's not going anywhere anytime soon. And it seems like it's going to be very expensive and very long. So there is no way that I'm going to be able to do this 100% alone. And that's an individual journey. I've spoken to thousands of people at this point over the last few years, and everybody, my mom and myself included, you just get there at different rates and different times and in different ways. But it was a total search and find exercise, and it was literally insane to me. I just couldn't wrap my brain around. It did not make sense to me how there could be so little help. And promise to my dad notwithstanding, that was all I needed to decide, hey, I have no idea where this is going to go, but I'm going to spend this entire next chapter of my life trying to figure out how to make this better, because this is horrible. Even looking historically, I look back at the history of how we've approached problems like HIV or oncology. The big difference, especially when compared to oncology, oncology has this almost warrior-like narrative to it. You're a fighter. You're a cancer survivor. There's a war on cancer. There is an arsenal of drugs. We bring a very militaristic warrior type of fight the enemy, and there is a clear enemy to fight. There is a abnormal growth of cells that we can see and target, and there's a picture that I can see in my body, and there is a physicality to it. I lose my hair, I lose weight, I go through the fight. And people know that. They're familiar with it. It's touched so many lives, they know it. And when you get a cancer diagnosis, there's this rally around it to fight. There is no such thing yet in the world of dementia, because we can't see. It's not obvious. You see someone walking through the airport and they're just strange. They're saying weird things, or they can't move in a way that you expect. And there's no, unless you're walking around with a nameplate or a shirt that says, excuse me, I have dementia, or my brain, the hardware and software is being hacked and removed in real time. There's not the same rally around it, and we don't have the same clarity collectively or same number of reps in understanding collectively what this means and what it means for everyone, because we just don't really know as much as I'm hoping we will continue to learn and know by the end of this decade. It's not that it is by default a death sentence, but a dementia diagnosis, any of the subtypes, unfortunately, especially if you don't ask for help, you kind of have to come to the realization in your own terms that all the trains are leading to the same station and you're going to die. And that's not any different than life itself. We're all going to die, but this diagnosis has introduced a forcing on you, a set of circumstances that you didn't foresee. And there's just way too many people that have to go do that without nearly enough help. And there's not nearly enough clarity or timely relevant support for the diagnosis, the stage that you're at, and the circumstances that you're in. That is one of the reasons why we are here and why we're doing what we're doing, is to bring that and make that available, because of how painful that was for us on the founding team and for the experience we've had with my dad or with Remo or what my mom's gone through. Status quo is just unacceptable. And yeah. So we're doing our best.
When my mom got sick, she was in Florida and I was in California. Tell me about the geography of your family. Who was where? And how do you think about caregiving up close versus caregiving at a distance?
So at the time, and even the path to diagnosis, I was in California and my parents were in New York. There's two parts. There is the pre-diagnosis to diagnosis, and then diagnosis to, let's call it, care plan. The what does this mean? What are we going to do? Who is going to do it? Where we did that remotely and had to deploy a lot of time and energy and money to move my dad from New York to California, from one part of California to another, to be able just to get the diagnosis. And we were very blessed and very fortunate to be able to be in a position to do that. But that's one of the key problems that we find ourselves in today, is oftentimes as a caregiver, especially as an adult child, where I'm just meeting way too many people in our demographic that are trying to do their best to live their own life or raise a family of their own, but also deal with aging parents, you're not in the same place. And there are no tools for you to be able to do that. So you may be able to find, okay, cool, there's a memory and aging center at UCSF, but my parents live in Kansas and they don't have any money. So what are we going to do? That's a very real problem. And millions of people are dealing with that as we speak on this recording. That is problem one. Once you solve that problem and then your diagnosis comes and you get sucked into the board game that you didn't ask for, now there's the, okay, here are all the things that we took for granted: getting dressed, driving, doing chores, paying bills. This is one of the things that I don't know if enough people are literally aware of, is like my mom right now, the person is still physically alive. Their body is still there. They want to move and do things, and they have to go to the bathroom and they need to eat. But their brain isn't working anymore. Imagine your typical day working as a parent, whatever your circumstances are in life. Just try to imagine for a moment. This person is physically with you, but they can't communicate and they can't do the air quotes sort of standard activities like wake up, get dressed, go to the bathroom, brush their teeth, eat, drink water, etc. What do you do with that person for the waking hours of their day? Just literally think about that for a moment. And that, to your question, is there's two parts to it. There's getting to figuring out the monster that you have to confront. What are the dragons that you have to slay along the way? And once you understand the journey that you're on to the best degree that you can, then there's the critical question of, okay, who is going to do it?
Yeah.
And there is a very day-to-day, hour-over-hour, dare I say, tactical component to that that you may have to live with for years. And that is where you need help. And there are really only three doors: do it yourself, friends and family, or professional service that you have to hire to come and do it. That's it. Right now, that's the best that we've got until something comes out of a lab somewhere and we can live in a world without these diseases. Those are your choices. There's a whole phase that we're now in, 7 or 8 years into the pathology with my dad. That's the phase that we're in now, which is there are crazy behaviors now that we deal with. And on a daily basis, I get the real-time stream of updates and I try to go home as much as I can. The air quotes solution that we've come up with, or what works now, is my older brother spends a lot of time with my mom at home, and we're extremely fortunate that he and I were able to get to a place where we could say, okay, if you take tactics, I'll take strategy. If you can help mom day to day, then I will take Remo becoming the thing that we wish we had. And Remo will be the new infrastructure to be able to bring this help in a way that is better, more accessible, more efficient, more helpful, or at least just, if we wind back the clock, what do we wish we had as a family when we were first walking out of the neurologist, or even that first endocrinologist after visit summary and referral? Starting from there, what did we wish that we had, and who are the people that we wish we met earlier, or the things that someone would have sat down and told us that we were going to have to do? You can never go backwards in life. And so that's how we've divided and conquered. But even with that, there is really no other problem I care about in the world than trying to honor that promise I made to my dad and just trying to make it, air quotes, better. Because we're just in a whole new phase of where we just have to ebb and flow with the tide of the behaviors that present themselves. And the last time I was home, I think probably the scariest moment I've had with him was he just had outright delirium. And it was the scariest thing I've ever seen. It was just incredible. I walked around in a fog for about a week after that. I couldn't believe, just, it was my dad, but it was like one of those horror films, like a demonic possession, like The Conjuring or something. It was just like something had taken hold of what looked like my dad. And looking into his eyes, there was something in there, but there was just a multi-hour period of just simultaneously crying, yelling at the top of his lungs, and just looking so scared and confused. It was just like every system was on at the same time. And I think the reality of this disease is like, that's the answer to your question. That is your question. What do you do? Who is the person that is going to be there and deal with that? And who's going to help them? What is the support network going to be to live through that every day? And that's the phase that we're in now. And we're very stubborn and fortunate to have come to the conclusion with family and friends. We just have a pretty constant rotation of help, both professional, my mom, my brother, me, and my sister. You do your best, but I think this is one of the things that drives us, and I hope to just keep making it a little bit better every day.
You mentioned the emotional challenge of seeing your dad in a state of delirium and how difficult that was. You mentioned the challenge of the moment you got the diagnosis, having to rewrite or reframe or reimagine so many things about the future. You also talked about how before your dad got sick, there were some elements of your relationship that you thought could use work or could use addressing, and that now that he is sick, that those opportunities might be lost. I think you used the phrase that those opportunities have been sealed in a tomb of dementia. So with all of the emotional challenges that arise with this disease, where do you turn? How do you cope? How do you move through those feelings? Because all we can do is move forward. You've talked a bit about how you orient yourself. How do I move forward? What do I do next? And so I'm just curious what you do with your grief, what you do with your anger, what you do with your regret, all of these big feelings. How do you work with those?
I run headfirst into whichever one I'm feeling. And I've had to grow tremendously in asking for help, starting with knowing myself well enough to identify what it is that I'm feeling and then communicating that to the people around me. Because it's not fair to expect them to understand always. It's like you have a little kid and you come home from work or you come to spend time with them. They're just excited to see you and they want to spend time with you. So if you're frustrated or pissed off or sad or you had a bad day or someone was a dick at work or whatever it was, they don't know. They're just excited that you're there. The direct answer to your question is I have found no other way to navigate what is happening other than to just ask myself really immediately, okay, what can I control and what can I not control? And I can control what I do and say and think. I can choose what to interpret something to mean, but I can't control most of what's going to happen. So I personally try to directly confront whichever emotion it is and the ones that you've alluded to. I feel all of them on a daily basis. But the thing that's changed over the past years is the time that it takes between feeling it and then what am I going to do or say or think about it. And I wouldn't even say that that's the answer or that I am a guru or I've achieved some sort of enlightenment here. It's just I haven't found any other way because it is so relentless and hard and terrifying and straight up is horrible to live with the body of someone that you are related to, but the person that you know is gone and there is no other way that I have been able to find. If anybody else has found a better way, I'm all ears. But I've just chosen to try on a daily basis to not hide from it, to be really honest with myself about it, to communicate that to the people around me so that they can understand why am I behaving or communicating in the way that I am. And then I personally feel enormous amount of gratitude every day in that there is something for me to channel all of this into. and that is Remo. And it's like having a nuclear reactor of drive and motivation and focus. And there are times where I can find superhuman levels of energy because of everything that we've talked about in this conversation. And I know that it's not going anywhere. So for all the therapists that are listening, they'll probably see all the flaws in where that psychology can get me into trouble. And it has. I'm not perfect. And I just always go back to, hey, what can I control? What can I control? And then I think about young Brendan saying, hey, this is an opportunity for excellence. I think about the conversation that I had with my dad and the promise that I made to him. And it's a day-to-day test to see, can I just do my best today and not always try to go much further than that? Because sometimes that's as far as you can see, and that's okay. And I wish somebody would have said that to me 8 years ago.
Well, as we wrap up, I want to end on a hopeful note. Tell me what you see in the future. What is your vision? This is kind of looped into the what's one thing you wish you knew before the journey started. I know that so much of your life's purpose has been channeled into making this entire journey better for others. So maybe you can just speak for a minute or two about the future of dementia care and what you're hoping for.
I see a world without these diseases. And I see a world where I am simultaneously humbled by and grateful for how many people are confronting this in their life now, and how many people are getting sucked into the Jumanji world. I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy, but what I see is a world without these diseases, because it is such a staggeringly large problem. The table is set for change to happen, and we are living through the time where we will decide how to treat dementia differently, starting with being able to detect it earlier, starting with being able to provide information and clarity earlier and faster in a way that's more relevant and more actionable, a way that's more affordable and accessible, and a way for technology to be married with the right expertise at the right time to help you figure out what to do now versus next versus later. And I think we are moving towards a world where we will continue to map and understand the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system and how and where these pathologies begin and where they start to break and where are the opportunities for better intervention. When I look into the future of dementia, I see the world that we're now living in with antiretroviral therapies with HIV, or the types of highly specialized and highly targeted therapeutics we have in oncology, and the entire support apparatus around all of those things, the destigmatization of it, the understanding that it's a very real problem and something that people empathize with. And there is a world and an infrastructure where not only can we understand what we're dealing with more quickly and more specifically, but the action you can take and the tools that you have at your disposal, whether that be a community of people to support you, the content or expertise to be able to plug you almost like in the Matrix to know Kung Fu, to what to do based on the diagnosis and stage, but then the outright care delivery itself, and that care delivery being able to be brought to you remotely and in a way that is augmented by the benefits that technology can bring, and in a way that you get to drive. And your journey through dementia is something that you get to decide, not be sucked in and happens to you. I don't imagine a world where you can control life. That's just not at all how I think about things. And that's one of the biggest lessons that what has happened with my dad has taught me, is you can't control so much of what happens, but what are you going to do with the time that you have? And when I look into the future, that's what I see. And I see people having more agency and certainly more choice in honoring their loved ones' wishes, allowing people to age with dignity and be able to live with or live without one of these diseases in the same way that we were able to, again, confront some of the big epidemiological problems that we've been confronted with whether that be HIV or oncology or even what happened most recently with COVID. I think it's incredible. We produced in the span of a year, 3 effective and novel vaccines. I think that that's something that unfortunately is lost in the din of day-to-day life and news. But when I see things like that, it makes me very optimistic. And when I look into the future, I see something to inspire a sense of purpose, whether as a caregiver or as a professional or as a provider or as a person who has this in their family tree or is maybe more genetically predisposed. I just think our understanding is going to get more comprehensive and more targeted, and we can ultimately live in a world where getting this diagnosis and then going and having to figure out what that means for yourself is just a thing of the past. And we'll look back and say, man, wasn't it so silly? I don't know if people know this, but like one of the key ways we used to detect diabetes was drinking urine and deciding whether it tasted sweet or not. That's kind of where we've been at in dementia care. When I look into the future, I think we can do a lot better than a finger stick in the wind or, hey, does this taste sweet to you? So that's what I see and that's what I think about. And it's a beautiful roller coaster trying to see this promise through and try to do everything that we can to bring that future into the present as quickly and safely and accessibly as we can. It's a good reason to get out of bed in the morning.
It sure is. And I just want to thank you, Matt, for the time that you've spent today speaking with me and sharing with the Remo audience the story of your dad, your family, your journey, and the fire that lives inside you and that inspires you to do this work, and a bit about where you see things going from here and how things can be better. It's just giving me a lot of energy to hear you speak about that. So I just wanted to say thank you again for coming on today to chat.
Oh, thank you for offering the opportunity to talk about it. And I think for anybody who has an opportunity to hear this, please know you're not alone. I certainly am always willing to talk to anybody, and I don't know everything. We don't know everything, but we're always trying to learn. And this promise is one that drives all of us. And this is what we do. This is all we do. This is our purpose. And so please recognize you're not alone and there is help for you, and it's not weakness to ask for it. And so hopefully this is helpful, and hopefully we can bring that future into the present sooner rather than later.
I have been speaking with Matt LeCrae, Remo co-founder and chief product officer. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening to Talking Dementia with Remo Health. If you're looking for more information, resources, and expert insights, visit remo.health and subscribe so you never miss an episode. Until next time, take care.